Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Donald Hoffman, author of The Case Against Reality: Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes, published in August by Norton. Don is the professor of cognitive sciences at the University of California. His previous works include Visual Intelligence, Observer Mechanics, many others, and catch his TED Talks and the podcasts, Ars Technica, or the three. The Case Against Reality is a book, if it actually exists, that treats reality as kind of a zero. Space-time either doesn't exist, or that we have no framework within which to determine or define what such a thing might be. We live in a world not that much different than the graphical user interface on our computers, the files, the folders, the other icons that kind of hide the reality of the mechanisms that lie beneath. A three-dimensional representation in an essentially two-dimensional surface. An apple that is 10 meters away is an apple that is easier to grasp than 1,000 meters away. So reality is, I don't know. The question in my mind, if my mind too exists, is one of solipsism, a concept, a construct that Donald vigorously denies, but if true, means that there is no me interviewing Dr. Hoffman, or there is simply me, the universe. All of this strains our ability to reason with the very tool we are reasoning with. So here we go. Let's talk with Donald. If we're going to talk about these concepts that kind of slip from my mind just after their form. So welcome, Don. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Sam. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, so it's interesting. In the past 2 weeks, I interviewed Michael Graziano on another book with a long subtitle, Rethinking Consciousness, A Scientific Theory of Subjective Experience. We spent an entire hour discussing the title. Then Philip Goff, same deal with the subtitle, Galileo's Error, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness. So given that, are you familiar with those guys?
Yes. Very, very interesting work for both of them.
Yeah, both of them were not upset, but I have this idea, maybe from the old album by The Police, you know, is there a ghost in the machine? And Dr. Graziano almost got mad at me when I suggested that. What do you think about that?
Well, yes, I don't think that there's a ghost in the machine in the following sense. I don't think that there's a machine. What we think of as fundamental, space and time and atoms and particles and so forth, this has been the framework that has been at the foundation of scientific reasoning for centuries, and has been a fantastically useful framework, led to a lot of beautiful science and technology and great insights. But the latest evidence from our best theories, Einstein's theory of space time, general and special relativity, quantum field theory, and now I'm saying evolution by natural selection, all three of the big pillars of science are telling us the same thing, that space-time is not fundamental. There's something deeper that we need to find, some new way of describing reality in which the very language of space and time and particles inside space and time, unitarity and locality, to be more technical, those terms don't apply in this deeper realm. And so there is the race is on among physicists. For example, Nima Arkani-Hamed at Princeton, Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, they're looking for the new structures deeper than space-time, deeper than microphysical particles that don't even have the language of locality in space and time. They don't have the very notions of space and time. And so the race is on for a deeper understanding. So space-time has had a good run. It's been very useful for several centuries, but now it's over. It's time to go deeper. And it's so evolution by natural selection, it turns out, is telling us exactly the same thing. And so our best theories are telling us it's over for space-time. It's over for the machine theory that we've had, and that's worked very well for several centuries. It's over for that version of the machine, and we need to look deeper. So that's what I'm after, and that's why I don't think that there is some notion of a ghost in the machine, because the very notion of the machine that we've assumed for centuries is the very thing that our best science is telling us needs to be abandoned, and we need to have a deeper notion.
Well, then, what are we actually talking about? Is this simply a construct as well? We are human beings, so we communicate in this fashion. And I can't really wrap my head around the idea that we're discussing the very concept by, as I said, using the very tool that we're discussing. We're conscious of this conversation. I don't see how that affects our fitness versus the nature of reality as it may exist. How can you explain that?
Well, so what our best science is telling us we have to do is to not let go of reason and logic. That's the evolutionary work that I've done doesn't say we need to let go of reason and logic. There's nothing in evolutionary theory that says that selection pressures have selected us to have poor reason and logic, whereas they have selected us to have no insight into the objective nature of reality in our sensory systems, that our sensory systems are effectively giving us a virtual reality that's just shaped to keep us alive, that lets us act in a way that keeps us alive without giving us any insights into the deep nature of reality. But that same logic does not turn out to turn against our own ability to reason or do mathematics. That's a separate cognitive capacity from our sensory systems, and it seems to be immune to the arguments that I and my team have from evolution by natural selection against our sensory systems being veridical. But what we're up against, it might sound impossible, it might sound contradictory, but really it's not, in the following sense. It used to be just obvious that the Earth was flat, and that the Earth, later on, that the Earth was the center of the universe, and it seemed just crazy to think that what anybody could see with their own eyes, that the Earth is, you know, reasonably flat, and of course it doesn't move. It's the stars and the sun and the moon go around the Earth, quite obvious to anybody who just looks. It seemed crazy to question what our senses were saying, but we learned to do it. It was a jarring experience, but we learned to do it. And now our science, again, you know, this is Einstein's theory of relativity, quantum field theory, and evolution by natural selection are all with one voice telling us that space-time is not a fundamental concept. It has to be emergent from a deeper concept. So it's not saying that it's over for science. It's not over for reason. It just means that a particular theory that we particularly liked, namely that space-time is fundamental, the microphysical particles are fundamental, that objects in space and time really exist whether or not they're perceived, and they have definite positions, momentum, firing rates in the case of neurons, and so forth. That assumption, which we're sort of programmed to like by evolution, that assumption, that framework is just wrong. That doesn't mean that we can't find a deeper framework, and eventually we will look at the current view that space-time is fundamental as sort of, curious in the same way that we look it back and see flat space-time and Earth, flat Earth and a geocentric universe. The Earth is the center of the universe. Those ideas which everybody believed centuries or millennia ago, they now look curious to us. They look sort of funny. And I think it'll be the same thing in a few decades about space-time. People will look back and go, why couldn't that generation just understand that evolution shaped us with a virtual reality headset instead of a window on the truth? It's And I think it'll be obvious for the next generation where, you know, they spend a lot of time in virtual reality worlds that are just as compelling and immersive as everyday life. It'll just be a no-brainer for someone, you know, a teenage kid to take off the headset and go, well, what about what I call everyday reality? That's probably just a VR headset too. It won't be a real stretch. What will be curious will be, you know, our generation that couldn't see it. And so I think there's no real logical problem. There's no real tough thing ahead. Is, you know, a lot of people think, well, how can we get a science outside of space and time? How could I even think outside of space and time? And it's a new way of thinking, but we can do it. And it turns out, you know, it is being done. I'm working with some colleagues on some mathematical models of potential models of reality outside of space and time. And physicists such as, again, Nima Arkani Hamed, he just gave a course last fall at Harvard, 20-plus lectures, where he's describing to the graduate students at Harvard how to think, how to do physics outside of space and time. And so it's on. The best and brightest are, you know, in physics are after it. And I think, you know, will, you know, our incredulity that we have to do this will just look sort of like a curious thing, just like, you know, flat Earth is a curious thing to us.
Well, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. I remember listening to Richard Feynman's lecture where he's talking about an alien race looking at us playing chess. And he thinks, okay, we understand it now. We've experimentally looked at this. We see all the moves. That the bishop moves diagonally, the rook can only move in straight line, the queen can do whatever she wants, the king can only move one space, and then all of a sudden someone castles and say, oh, well, what the heck is that? That's just like Arthur Eddington going to look at an eclipse and recognizing that light is bent by the space-time continuum. Those are all experimentally valid ways of doing what you've just described. But this, much like string theory, there aren't experiments, you know, just me throwing this out. I don't know how you can experimentally prove or disprove the things that you just postulated. I don't mean to be pushing this as hard as I am. It's just I don't understand it.
Oh, sure. That's a great question. So there are ways to experimentally test these new theories that are being developed of a reality beyond space and time. And that's, of course, the gold standard that we want in any science is to make testable predictions. So how do we do that in this case? It's quite straightforward. You make a mathematically precise model of some deeper reality outside of space and time. In the case, for example, of Nima Arkani Hamed and his team, they're looking at things called positive Grassmannians and amplitudehedrons and so forth. But they can then show how these deeper structures precisely project back into what we call normal space-time. So these deeper models don't have locality and unitarity, the things that you see in space-time. They don't have those properties in the deeper reality, but they show how these deeper models, when you project in a specific way, so they have to say exactly what the projection is of the deeper reality into our space-time. Once you write that down, then you can see, does our deeper reality project into, for example, the theories that we know and love already that have great empirical support. And so you have to show that your deeper dynamics outside of space-time projects into, for example, Einstein's special relativity and general relativity and quantum field theory when you look at it, its projection into space-time. The same thing, the work that I'm doing in terms of a model of reality and dynamics outside of space-time, that will be exactly the same constraint on my theory that my team is working on. When we project it back into space-time, we have to make predictions first that are compatible with known science, Einstein's theory and quantum field theory and evolution by natural selection. But then any new predictions that we make will be predictions that we'll have to say, here's the test that you can do inside space-time. And I would point out in the case of string theory that at least for a certain kind of space called anti-de Sitter space, string theory and quantum field theory are precisely the same thing. So in anti-de Sitter space, string theories are exactly the same thing as quantum field theories. However, in our universe is not anti-de Sitter, it's a de Sitter space, and things are a little bit trickier, but it's not like string theory doesn't have – the reason why string theory is taken seriously by many brilliant physicists is because it satisfies all the constraints of quantum field theory and more constraints. It's not less constrained than our best firm theories. It's more constrained. So from the point of view of a physicist, there's already incredible evidence for much of string theory. So it's not like it's just someone pulled something, you know, out of the air and put it down there and there's no test for it. There are many, many aspects of string theory that are forced on us by what we already know from thousands of experiments. Now, there are new predictions that string theory makes that are real predictions that we don't have the technology. You know, we don't have the energies. We need to go down to Planck scale sizes and so forth to test them. So current technology can't you know study those, but you know most physicists would agree that you know string theory has and you know it arose out of the many constraints from the experiments that have been done.
Well, let's look at it on a much simpler basis and one that the general public has come to embrace.
Okay.
The idea of an atom looking like a solar system with an electron orbiting the proton, and it's barely within our capabilities of understanding, like the big globe they have at CERN with a millimeter ball in the middle, and then you go way, 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 way out, and that's the electron. But that's not what's happening. These are fields. And even the word field is another, essentially, a graphical user interface. So what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to do something? Am I supposed to understand something? Am I just leaving it to you to delve deeper into this? When will you be able to tell me? When will anyone be able to tell me? And can that actually happen?
What's the reality behind space-time?
What is it? What does this look like? And even when you use the word look, it doesn't. So right. I don't know. I understand what you're saying. But then I don't know how I can decipher what these fields, and I keep saying, look like. I'm not supposed to do that. I'm supposed to be doing something that creates fitness for me, like looking at a beautiful woman and saying she seems to be someone that can continue the gene pool in the way I want it to continue. And that's how you begin your book.
Right. So this is a wonderful challenge in the following sense. Our best theories are telling us that space-time cannot be fundamental, that we're going to have to think of a theory outside of space and time. And for most of us, it's hard to even imagine what that might be like, because in some sense, you can't picture it directly. But what we do now is what always happens in science, and what makes it fun. Science is a very creative process. You start off with an idea that you think is an important idea that will take you to the next step beyond the current science. Like Einstein, back in around 1907 or so, had what he called his most wonderful idea. I forgot exactly what words, but you know, the best idea he'd ever had. And it was that effectively, if you're falling in an elevator that's in free fall, you'll be weightless. And that was the basic idea that he used to try to understand gravity. But from the time he had that idea until he actually turned that into a theory, it was another 7 years or 8 years. So it took him 7 or 8 years of hard work, and this is Einstein, right? This is not some stupid guy. It took him 7 or 8 years to go from his big insight into a mathematically precise theory. And that's what science is about. We have the creative leaps of imagination, and most of them, of course, are wrong. But every once in a while, we leap into something that's right, or it's the next step we need to take. But then we have to turn it into pure math. And once you do that, then the math becomes your teacher. So in the case of Einstein, for example, he wrote down his equation of general relativity. And a year later, someone came up with a solution that Einstein had never anticipated. A guy named Schwarzschild came up with a solution that were black holes. And Einstein hadn't anticipated black holes. He didn't believe in them. He disliked them. But black holes exist, and the theory was actually smarter than Einstein. And so that's what we're going to have to do here. We will have ideas. Now, in the case of Nima Arkani Ahmed, what he's doing is he's not going after some big new fundamental idea about the nature of the universe. He's trying to just make mathematical leaps to a deeper realm where the leaps are inspired by the idea that whatever leap I take, I need to be able to project it back into space-time and get what we know and love in the physics of space-time. I'm taking a different kind of leap. I'm working on consciousness. Very, very simple notions of consciousness, like the taste of chocolate, the feeling of a headache, the smell of a rose, those kinds of simple sensory conscious experiences. And we've had a very, very difficult time in the sciences within a physicalist framework of trying to explain how unconscious matter in space-time, like particles, computer systems, or neural systems, could somehow create our conscious experience of the taste of chocolate, or create the illusion of the experience of the taste of chocolate. Some physicalist colleagues of mine, friends of mine, will say there are no conscious experiences. We only have the illusion of conscious experiences. But in either case, what we've utterly failed to do is to write down a mathematically precise scientific theory that says exactly what physical systems and dynamics, whether it be computational systems, functional systems, neural systems, microtubule systems, global workspace systems, we've utterly failed to say precisely what systems give rise to specific conscious experiences, like the taste of vanilla. If your idea is that neural activity, maybe with high integrated information, is somehow creating the conscious experience of vanilla, well, great. Say exactly what the computational structure is, what the system dynamics is, precisely the class of those dynamics that is the taste of vanilla or the illusion of the taste of vanilla, and why they could not be the taste of chocolate or the illusion of the taste of chocolate. There's literally nothing on the table. Not one specific conscious experience can be explained by any of the current attempts at a scientific theory. That's a really desperate situation that we are in the sciences. If we start in space and time, if we start with microphysical particles and objects in space time, that they're fundamental, we come up a complete blank. We can't explain any particular conscious experience or the illusion of any particular conscious experience. And so that's why I've been saying, well, our best science is telling us that space-time and objects in space-time aren't fundamental anyway. And evolution is telling us that these are just virtual reality icons that we've, been shaped by evolution to have. They're just like in virtual reality. If you look, say you're playing a video game in virtual reality of racing cars, and you look over to your right with you have a headset on. You look over to your right and you see a green Corvette, someone's driving, and you look over to your left, you see a red Mustang. Well, when you look over and see the green Corvette, you create the green Corvette when you look, and then when you look to your left and you see the red Mustang, you're deleting the green Corvette, and now you're creating the red Mustang. Of course, in the reality, in this metaphor, there is no There are no Corvettes or Mustangs. There's a supercomputer in this metaphor. That's the reality behind what you're seeing. So you, as you move your headset around, you're rendering objects, you're creating objects in a virtual, so they're virtual objects in a virtual space-time, and then you're deleting them. And I'm saying that's what we do all the time. Space-time is our virtual reality headset. The moon is a 3D object that we render when we look, and we delete it when we look away. So these things, and the same thing with brains and neurons. Yeah, anytime you look inside a skull, you will see brains and neurons. But you're creating those in your virtual reality, just like you create a Corvette in the VR, video game. You create the Corvette when you look, you delete it when you look away. When you look inside a skull, you see neurons. When you look away, there are no neurons. There is some reality, but it's not anything in space and time. And so we just have to understand that we've just assumed the wrong things are fundamental. We've assumed that objects in space-time are real and have causal powers. We've assumed that neurons literally exist when they're not perceived, and they create our conscious experiences, they create our actions. And for everyday neuroscience, that's fine to think of it that way, but it's strictly speaking a fiction. And that fiction is no longer harmless when we're trying to understand the relationship between consciousness and the human brain. In that case, the fiction bites us. It's very much like a user who says, well, yeah, the icons on my desktop, if I'm using a paint program, it's that paintbrush on the screen that's really creating the colors and shapes that I see on my screen. And for the casual user, that's perfectly fine. But for someone who's actually trying to build software that does graphics, that illusion is no longer harmless. That you have to get past that illusion if you're going to build software. You have to realize that the tools that you see on your desktop are merely symbols. They have no causal powers. And that's the same thing with space and time. For most science, it's perfectly harmless to think of space and time and physical objects as real and having causal powers. Perfectly fine. But for the problem of consciousness, it turns out no longer to be harmless. We have to get under the hood and understand, just like a software developer has to get under the hood of the software and not be caught in the illusion that the icons on the desktop are real. And so the theory I'm working on is to say, so what is the reality behind space and time? Well, let's come up with a model in which consciousness itself, a mathematically precise model of consciousness, is fundamental, and show how a dynamics of this realm of conscious agents, as I call them, to show how the dynamics of conscious agents will give rise to space and time, and Einstein's theory of space-time, quantum field theory, and evolution by natural selection. So as you can see, there are lots of tools that we have to pursue this. Science is a method. It's a method of careful observation, precise theories, and going back and forth between theories and observations. Space-time is just one particular theory. It's a theory that we've liked. The idea that physical objects in space and time are fundamental is not an essential assumption of science. It's one contingent theory that science has used for a few centuries, and it's been a useful theory, and it's now time to abandon it. Space-time is not fundamental. Objects in space and time do not have causal powers. For some purposes, it's a useful fiction to think that way, and it's a harmless fiction. But to really move on in our science, we have to get past it, just like we had to get past flat Earth and a geocentric universe.
Well, it's interesting, since you talked about chocolate and vanilla, and since you talked a lot about the graphical user interface, I should probably go back to the question I might have asked initially. Because for those who haven't read the book, and practically speaking, this interview in part is designed to sell the book, tell us about the apple, not Newton's apple, but the apple that you perceive a meter away. Because that apple appears repeatedly throughout the entire book.
Yes. So most of us, if you see an apple on the table in front of you, we assume that our perceptual systems, our eyes, are showing us truths about objective reality. That not the whole truth, but we do believe that if I see a red apple a meter away, that in fact there is in objective reality a red apple a meter away, and it has roughly the shape and the colors that I see. And we say that, you know, of course, there are ways to test that assumption. I can say I can close my eyes and I can put my hand out and feel the apple. So that proves the apple is still there. Or I can close my eyes and have my friend, you know, Mary, reach out and touch it or look at it. And she can tell me, yeah, the apple is still there even when you don't look. And so we take that as evidence that the apple exists and has the properties that we see even when we're not looking. And the very same, so I'm saying that that's false, that it, and evolution by natural selection entails that it's false. So the idea, most of us think that, you know, natural selection should shape our perceptions to show us reality as it is, that that those of our ancestors who saw reality more accurately would have a competitive advantage in the basic activities of life, feeding, fighting, fleeing, and mating, and that therefore they would be more likely to pass on their genes, which code for truer perceptions. And so after, you know, thousands of generations of that, we can be quite confident we're the offspring of those that in each generation saw more accurately. And so we can be confident that we see reality as it is more accurately. And it turns out that that intuitive belief about evolution by natural selection is deeply false. When you actually study the theory, and it turns out it's mathematically precise theory now. There's something called evolutionary game theory that was first started by an English mathematician, John Maynard Smith, back in the 1970s. So it's now we know with mathematical precision what we mean by talking about evolution by natural selection, and we can use the equations to actually ask the technical question: does evolution favor the evolution of sensory systems in humans or other creatures that show truths about objective reality? Not all the truth, but truths that, you know, that are important in your niche. And the answer is absolutely not. I'll put it very, very simply. Organisms that see reality as it is go extinct when they compete against organisms of equal complexity that see no aspect of reality and are just tuned to the fitness payoffs. So the idea then is that the apple that I'm seeing is very much like the Corvette in the virtual reality. I turn my headset to the right and I see the Corvette. I turn to the left and I delete the Corvette. It no longer exists. But if I'm playing a social, you know, interactive game, someone else with the VR headset, I can ask them, well, you know, hey Joe, I'm not looking at the Corvette. Can you see it? And Joel looks over, yeah, I can still see the red Corvette, you know, it's still going there. Does that prove that there really is a red Corvette? No, it just means that Joe renders his red Corvette and can render it when I'm not rendering mine. So all the, if you think about all the things that you would use to prove that the apple exists, even when you're not perceiving it, you can do all those things with in virtual reality with a red Corvette. And you'll see that, yeah, I could, you know, if I have force feedback, I could close my eyes and I could reach over and touch the red Corvette and so forth and get force feedback on it. So all the examples we use to prove to ourselves that the moon exists or an apple exists or that neurons exist when they're not perceived, all of those thought experiments fail. You can do them in virtual reality you'll see that you get the same result. So the idea then is, what has evolution given us? If evolution has not given us sensory systems that are a window on the truth, what did it give us? And the idea is that, think about it as a user interface, like the, you know, the desktop interface on your computer. If you're, you know, writing an email and you know, the icon for the email that you're writing is blue and rectangular and in the middle of your screen, does that mean that the, you know, email itself in your computer is blue and rectangular and in the middle of your computer? No, of course not. Anybody who thought that misunderstands the whole point of the desktop interface. It's not there to show you the truth of the computer, which in this metaphor is, you know, the circuits and software and voltages and magnetic fields. In fact, the desktop interface is there to hide all of that truth. If you had to toggle voltages to craft an email, your friends wouldn't ever hear from you. And that's what evolution has done for us. It's given us sensory systems that show us a world of space and time. Our desktop is space-time. And the icons are 3D objects. So we have space-time as our desktop, 3D objects are the icons on our desktop, and the whole point of looking is to hide the truth and give us simple eye candy or sensory candy that hides reality and lets us interact with that reality in the ways we need to survive without knowing, in fact, doing an objective reality. Just like most of us have no idea, if you use a paint program, you take a paintbrush and you're making something on screen, most of us have no idea what's happening with the magnetic fields and voltages inside the computer. Most of us don't want to know. If you had to deal with it, you know, at that level, you couldn't do the paint program and you couldn't make your art. And so that's what evolution has done for us. It completely hides reality. Behind a virtual headset of, you know, space and time and 3D objects. And using that virtual headset, we're allowed to play the game of life and survive long enough to reproduce and pass on our genes to the next generation. But seeing the truth is not part of the game.
It's funny because in the past 5 minutes, you've used the word game several times. And a lot of the book, it's nice that the book has so many different recurrent but different themes. And one of them is the concept of game theory. And for the general public, a game is a simulation. A game is something you play for fun. So if you're looking at this whole thing as some type of game where we're moving towards fitness, which favors a clearer perception of what might very well be reality. For example, what is the game we're playing now? Is it a zero-sum game that has no stakes at all? We are having this conversation. Presumably, it has some purpose.
Well, and this is a very, very deep question. So as we try to come up with scientific theories that go beyond space and time, we will have to ask the question, what is the nature of reality behind space-time? And what is it up to? What is that deeper game? And how does that game project into what we see within space-time? In other words, within space-time, we see, for example, evolution by natural selection, which does seem to be something like a zero-sum game, right? You know, we're competing for a limited amount of resources. If I get more of the resources, you get less of the resources. If one of us has to die, then, you know, again, it's a zero-sum game. You know, someone wins and stays alive, someone dies. And is that a deep insight into reality, or is that an artifact? Is there a deeper game that might not be a zero-sum game, but when we look at it within the framework of space and time, it appears like a zero-sum game. So it's going to be very interesting to pursue that. I mean, I'm looking at a theory, the one I'm looking at, and of course, we're going outside of space and time. It's anybody's guess what the ultimate reality behind space and time might be. So, of course, what I'm proposing is probably wrong, but the idea is to be bold, to go beyond space and time, and to make proposals that are mathematically precise so that we can find out precisely where we're wrong. So that's the name of the game. You've got to be bold, but you've also got to be humble and say, of course, I'm probably wrong, but let's put something mathematically precise on the table so we can find out precisely why it's wrong and maybe fix it so it's less wrong. And so the theory I'm working on involves a mathematical model of which you might think of it as a vast social network of conscious agents. Think of it like the Twitterverse, right? The Twitterverse, there are tens of millions of users, billions of tweets, and there's lots of stuff trending. There's no way that any one Twitter user could ever interact with all the tens of millions of other Twitter users or read all the billions of tweets. You just couldn't do it. You know, there's not enough time. So what do we do when we're trying to understand the overwhelming data, the big data of a vast social network like the Twitterverse. What we do is we use visualization tools. These visualization tools allow us to visualize, say, what's trending in New York versus London, or to zoom out and say what's happening in all of the United States or all of Australia, or zoom into a particular small city, you know, what's happening in Rochester, New York. So if it's a good tool, of course, the tool is going to throw away most of the information about the Twitterverse, right? Because you can't see all the details. So it's going to summarize and throw away a lot of stuff, but it will allow you to zoom in or zoom out and see things that are trending. And it will give you, simple eye candy, like if it's a VR thing, maybe three-dimensional colored objects that move in certain ways, have certain shapes that you can understand, so that you can see, what's trending in London is this, but what's trending in Los Angeles is that, and I can understand what's going on. And so that's what I mean. Space-time and physical objects are. We are a bunch of conscious agents, and we happen to have a visualization tool for interacting with this vast network of other conscious agents. And our visualization tool, our headset, is space-time and physical objects. That's not the objective reality. It's just our little visualization tool that allows us to interact with this vast social network of other conscious agents. And so we've made a rookie mistake on this view. We've mistaken our headset. We've mistaken our data compression scheme, our visualization tool. We've mistaken that for the thing that it's actually designed to allow us to interact with. So we've mistaken our tool, the visualization tool, for the thing that is visualizing the reality. So the idea then is that on this view, reality is a vast social network of interacting conscious agents that are completely mathematically defined. We can define their dynamics. And now I can finally get to your question. What is it about? Right. I had to give that background to actually try to address your question. So what if there's I'm claiming there's a network of conscious agents and they're doing something, what are they doing and why are they doing anything? Why does consciousness need to do anything? Right. And of course, any theory that we have of objective reality is going to face the same kind of question, right? If there is a dynamics outside of space and time, what is the dynamics about, and why should there be a dynamics? Why is something happening as opposed to nothing happening? And now the answer in my case is, again, I don't know, but there is one idea, and so far only one idea that I've come across that seems deep enough to at least be a candidate to take seriously. I'm not saying it's necessarily true, but at least I can't dismiss it for just being too shallow. And the idea it requires two background ideas to understand it. First, the first idea that you need to understand is that it turns out when we think about consciousness, most of us think of consciousness as sort of amorphous, you can't put your fingers on it, it's squishy, you can't pin it down. Well, it turns out science has been studying conscious experiences quite carefully for 160 years. There's a field called psychophysics that was started in 1860, roughly, by Gustav Fechner, and has become quite sophisticated. And what we've discovered, the bottom line, is that every time we study specific conscious experiences, we find that they are structured. They're not amorphous. They have very exquisite mathematical structures. And we've been able to write down lots of structures for when you see a three-dimensional object, symmetry groups of the shapes, reflectance functions, all sorts of things. We can write down with mathematical precision descriptions of your experiences, color spaces, and so forth. And by the way, that's why we're able to create virtual realities. Right, you put on a headset, and we can now immerse you in a world we want to, worlds you've never seen before. How is it that we can do that? Well, because we understand with mathematical precision how your conscious experiences work. And as a result, we can write mathematically precise programs in computers and play you. We can make you have, with mathematical precision, whatever conscious experiences we want. So that's the first thing to note, is that conscious experiences have mathematical structure. We've been uncovering that mathematical structure, and that's without that, we couldn't do virtual reality. But because we understand the structure of human conscious experiences, we can start to play them and put you in virtual worlds. So that's the first point. Mathematical structure and consciousness are not separate from each other. Every conscious experience has mathematical structure. Now, the next concept is, if we're proposing, in this model I'm proposing, again, I'm probably wrong, but hey, you have to play along and see where it goes. In this model, consciousness is fundamental, and it's all that there is, what I call conscious agents. So in that, under that assumption that conscious agents, not space-time, consciousness and conscious agents are fundamental, and all these conscious agents are, you know, have mathematical structure, then, in fact, mathematical structure can only be about consciousness. That's all there is. Consciousness and conscious agents are all there is. So that means that mathematics, under this model, has always been and will only ever be about consciousness and conscious agents. So now, given that idea, here's the final idea that gets to what this is all about. There was a guy named Kurt Gödel, a brilliant mathematician in the 20th century, a friend of Einstein. They used to hang out at Princeton together, go on long walks together. He proved one of the most profound results in all of human thought. He proved in what's called Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And intuitively, what he showed is there's no end, in principle, no end to the exploration of mathematical structure. No matter how much we explore and how much we discover, we'll effectively have not even begun, because there'll be countless other realms of mathematical structure to explore. And this is a principled, so it's impossible to ever, even God cannot go after all the mathematical structures. They're boundless. So, now putting this all together, there's endless mathematical structures to explore. Mathematical structures are only, in this model, about possibilities of consciousness, possible kinds of conscious experience and conscious agents. That means that there's endless possibility for consciousness to explore different forms of consciousness. And so this is what I would call the kid in the candy store theory of consciousness, that it is Gödel's candy store. There's an infinite variety of conscious experiences and conscious agencies to explore. In principle, it can never end, and that's what it's all about. What the whole game is about is exploring this endless variety of consciousnesses in Gödel's candy store, and that's what we're doing. And as scientists and as human beings, we're just involved in exploring one out of the countless forms of conscious experience. So our experience here of 3D space and time and physical objects, we've taken that to be the fundamental objective reality. Hardly. This is one little tiny bit of mathematical structure in the infinity of Gödel's candy store. We've mistaken it for the final reality. So physicalism, the assumption that space-time and microphysical particles is fundamental reality, from this point of view, would be a very, very silly mistake. We're looking at one little piece of candy in an infinite candy store, and we're saying this is the final reality. No, that's just one little piece of candy in the infinite candy store. And by the way, this is great job security for science. This means that there's endless exploration for science. So scientists can get on board with this, perhaps. You know, there's no end to this. But it may be wrong, but at least it's deep enough. It's saying the reason that there is a dynamics of consciousness is principled. Consciousness could never, ever come to the end of the exploration of its possibilities. It's a theorem. It could never come to the end of it, the exploration of the possibilities. And so that's why there's going to be this endless and lovely pursuit of all the different varieties of conscious experience. And that's what it's about. So what we'll have to do is model that endless exploration of conscious possibilities, show that when we project it into space and time, that dynamics of conscious looks like evolution by natural selection. It looks like quantum field theory, and it looks like Einstein's theory of space-time. That will be the constraint on this theory of the endless exploration of consciousness. So we'll see how it goes. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, and it's funny because there's so many things you just said, and some of them I've written down and some I can remember. But you said something, well, a lot of the words you used were about play, were about games, game theory, that they're two completely different things, but they all involve the concept of simulation. And whether you're talking about Gödel or Turing or the Principia Mathematica, which, you know, Bertrand Russell said broke his brain, you're talking about simulations. So, and as you said, you know, if the universe, if the multiverse is as simple as froth, then no, we never ever will be able. And whether you're talking about a Turing machine or whether you're talking about a theory of incompleteness or one of Rudy Rucker's books, the idea is that what I said at the outset is that how are you supposed to do this using the very thing that you are attempting to understand? That's why I can't reject solipsism completely, because it seems, it's like Occam's razor. It seems like it's simplest for me to simply assume, because you can't disprove it, that I am the universe, you do not exist. And also, it's clearly true that when I die, you no longer exist either. I only have this wetware, and that's it. I can't go outside of this skull. I can only stay in here. When I die, you will die as well. There is no question about that in my mind.
Right. So solipsism, just maybe some people might not know what solipsism is. Solipsism is the doctrine that all that exists, the totality of all existence, is me and my experiences. So it's, you are just a figment of my imagination, and you have no conscious experiences at all. I'm the only thing that has conscious experiences, but I make up all these other people, and I make up all these animals and so forth, and I make up the story that they have conscious experiences, but in fact they don't. There's only one consciousness, and it's mine. And there's only one kind of thing in the whole universe, and that's my conscious experiences. That's solipsism. And indeed, you're correct that it cannot be disproved. There's no way to mathematically disprove it. Now, most scientists and philosophers are not solipsists, even though it can't be disproven. Of course, it can't also be proven. It can't be proven that that's the case either. So it can't be proven or disproven. Most scientists and philosophers find it to be a framework that's not very profitable in terms of developing their own philosophical or scientific theories. But that, again, doesn't disprove solipsism. Now, the framework that I'm working on isn't solipsistic in the following sense. I'm not just saying that my consciousness is the only consciousness. I'm saying there's an infinite variety of conscious agents. You have a consciousness. You also have more than one conscious agent. An aspect of the theory I'm working on is that you also have two conscious agents that combine together to form the one conscious agent that's you. And each of those two conscious agents itself is actually formed by the combination of countless other conscious agents interacting. And so we're each of us a single conscious agent, but also a huge lattice of interacting, a dynamical system of interacting conscious agents. And so this is the opposite of solipsism. It's a widely distributed notion of consciousness across this vast social network of conscious agents. But they also do combine to effectively form one huge conscious agent. So it's quite interesting. It's both true that there are countless conscious agents, and there's also one, which is the combination of the countless many. So, but you're right. You can't disprove solipsism, but I think that most philosophers and scientists would you know, admit that, but say, you know, there are lots of other theories we can't dismiss either that we in fact don't take too seriously.
Yeah, it's funny because if it's true, it doesn't really make any difference because nothing you say means anything. It's just my simulation of you. And granted, yes, no reason, no way to disprove it, but it really doesn't make any difference.
Right. And if I'm a solipsist, I can't wonder why there aren't more people who are also solipsists like me.
No, it's impossible. It's funny, from personal experience, I can remember as far ago when I was 3 years old, and I honestly thought that when my parents put me to bed, that the entire universe was disassembled.
Interesting.
They took everything, put it away, there was nothing left. And just before I woke up, they put everything back together again. And that's the way I remember thinking that the world existed. And your theories, especially about the blue car and the green car, the Mustang, is almost exactly like that.
That's right. So the space-time physical world that we think that we're in is something that we're creating and destroying all the time. Just like in virtual reality, you are creating and destroying I look over there, I see the Corvette, I'm creating it. I look away, I'm destroying it. There is no real Corvette in the computer that's running the virtual reality game. It's the same thing with physical objects, the sun and the moon. Make it big. The sun and the moon are objects that we create in our headset when we look, and we destroy them when we look away. There is a reality that exists independent of whether I look at it, but that's not anything inside space and time. It's not anything like the sun or the moon or physical objects. Those are just little icons that we create and destroy in our headset. And, of course, I don't know what the deeper reality is. My proposal that it's this vast social network of conscious agents is just a proposal. We'll see if it pans out. And even if it does pan out, it doesn't. We can never prove a scientific theory. That's an interesting thing about science. No scientific theory can ever be proved. You can always get evidence that you would use to increase the credence that you give to a scientific theory or decrease the credence that you give a scientific theory. But you can never literally prove your scientific your theory. So that's just the nature of the game. It's not just my theory that suffers that. It's any scientific theory. So my proposal that is a vast network of conscious agents, what it has going for it is that it can be made mathematically precise. At top level, it seems to be, a fit to what evolution by natural selection is telling us. And we'll see if we can get the dynamics of conscious agents to actually give rise to quantum field theory, general relativity, and evolution by natural selection when we project it into this headset of space and time. I think we'll be able to do it, but that'll be fun.
Let's do this. Okay. If you take Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty, and you say it's the observer that changes the very nature of reality in the sense of looking at an electron. Without looking at an electron, when you look at an electron, you can see either its position or its speed or acceleration. But it's only when you look at it that those two things are essentially dissected. So if you inductively go to your apple, it's the very nature of the observation that I'm confused. This is so hard to keep in your head. For you, it isn't, but for the layman, it's incredibly difficult, because what you're saying is, yes, I look at the apple, it's there. I look away, it's not there. Yet, it is there. You do it two ways. You have it there, but you have the human being looking at it, creating it essentially, looking away, as you said, destroying it. And so, but then deeper down, you actually say it does exist. That's where it becomes, it hurts. It hurts to think about it.
Right. So what I'm saying is, I'll put it this way, even your body, your hands and your face and your everything, those are just an icon as well. You literally are not in space and time. So this is the big change that we have to make in our worldview. We think of space and time as the big stage, the pre-existing stage on which the drama of life plays out. It started 13.8 billion years ago at the Big Bang, and there were only unconscious things, space-time, particles, and energy, no consciousness, no life. It took hundreds of millions, billions of years for life to emerge, and then after that, hundreds of millions of years for the first flickers of consciousness to emerge. And that's the framework that we're thinking about. When we're thinking about ourselves as little bit players that are relative latecomers on the big stage of space-time, the stage that's always been there for 13.8 billion years. I'm saying that whole story is wrong. Huh. We are not little bit players in the pre-existing stage of space-time. It's just the reverse. We are not inside space-time. We create space-time. It's a little data structure that we use. We are conscious agents, not stuck in space. We're outside of space-time. We just happen to use a little simple data structure called space-time with little things in it like stars and planets and moons and so forth as little symbols. But these are all data structures that we use as ways of interacting with other conscious agents. So the data structure, for example, when I see your body, I'm getting a symbol in my little space-time headset that I've created that gives me a portal into your consciousness, right? So all I see when I look at you is skin, hair, and eyes, and all I can see if I look in the mirror, if I look at my own face in the mirror. We each know, you look at your face in the mirror, all you see is skin, hair, and eyes, but you know firsthand that what you can't see in the mirror, the real you, the rich world of your conscious experiences, your hopes, your dreams, your emotions, your love of various kinds of music and so forth, your political views, all that deep world of your conscious experiences is hidden behind a very simple symbol, your face, your body. But your face and your body, that's not you, that's just a symbol. But when I look at your face and your body, that's a portal. I have a small your consciousness, a very fallible one, but real. If I see that you're smiling, I can guess reliably that you're probably happy. If I see you frowning, I can guess that you're unhappy. So my interface gives me portals into the realm of conscious agents. When I look at my cat, my portal isn't quite as clear. I can guess that it likes certain kinds of cat food and so forth, but I have no idea what it's like to be the consciousness of a cat. When I see something that I call an ant, my interface is very, very poor. And when I see things that we call, atoms and rocks and particles and so forth, my interface has given up. Well, no surprise. That's the whole point of an interface. It's there to hide most of the reality and to just give you little bits of insight where you need it. And so the insights we're getting are with what we call other human beings. That's the most insight we get into other conscious agents. So the idea here is that there's this vast realm of conscious agents, this vast social network outside of space and time. It's not inside space and time. Your consciousness may use space and time as a particular data structure that's useful for interacting with other consciousnesses. But I bet most other conscious agents will use different data structures. There's no reason why all the conscious use space and time and 3D objects. There's probably an infinite variety of different interfaces that agents use. And probably many agents always assume that their interface is the truth. And maybe it's part of a waking up that many conscious agents have to go through to realize, oh, wait, this is just an interface. This isn't the truth, and I'm not some little tiny thing inside space and time or whatever the interface is. So I'll use space and time because that's ours. I'm not some little, tiny little, 100-pound, 200-pound creature inside a universe that's just infinitely massive and so forth. It's the other way around. I'm not in space and time. Space and time is my data structure. I create the moon when I look. I delete it when I don't look. I create the sun when I look. I delete it when I don't look. What I'm really interacting with is the vast network of conscious agents. What I see is a moon or a sun, but that's just a way of dumbing things down so I can understand what's going on. So that's why I'm not actually saying that I have a real body in space and time and that, I'm somehow special in a way that the apple isn't. The apple only exists when it's perceived. My body in space-time only exists when it's perceived, because space-time itself only exists when it's perceived. Space-time is not fundamental. It's just our data structure. For computer scientists, this is a fairly straightforward kind of idea, but for most of us, it's really hard to think of space-time as just a data structure that we're creating. It's so built into us to assume that it's the pre-existing stage on which the drama of life plays out, and it's not.
It's funny because a lot of this reminds me of dorm room conversations at 3 o'clock in the morning, sometimes when I was in an altered state of consciousness.
Yes.
And you know, it's funny. It's like comfortably numb. When I was a child, I caught a glimpse out of the corner of my eye to look, but it was gone. I cannot put my finger on it now. The child is gone. The dream is gone. The child is gone. The dream is gone. Or it's when I was in such an altered state, I understood. There was an understanding of all of this in my mind. It was incredible insight with no experience behind it. But there was an insight, and I saw. I could see exactly how all of this worked. The idea that we're in the middle of everything, and no matter where we are, we're in the middle of everything. Things like that. And I could see spheres within spheres within spheres, infinite in all directions. But what you're saying is, we're not in a dorm room. I'm not in an altered state of consciousness. I'm reading your book, which is also a simulation. So, you're saying something that people don't say. And you're saying something just like, again, like, okay, the universe goes on forever and someone says to you, well, what's beyond that? Or what, is there a wall at the end? And then what's beyond that? What you're saying is we exist outside of a space-time continuum. You're actually saying that. And by saying that, anyone who reads this book, or most, or me, is going to ask the obvious question, then what are we in? If we are outside of space and time, what are we in? Or are we?
Right. Well, in... So we are not in space and time. That's just the model that we create. And we ourselves transcend space and time. We're the authors of space and time. So instead of being bit players on the stage of space-time, we're the authors. We're the creators of space-time. And in the work I'm doing on conscious agents, the agents themselves do not exist in space-time. They what they have are a wide variety of conscious experiences among all the conscious agents, and an infinite variety of conscious experiences, most of which you and I couldn't even concretely imagine. Like if I ask you to imagine a specific color that you've never seen before, you know, just try a specific color you've never seen before. Try to imagine a concrete one. Well, nothing happens, right? Smoke comes out of my ears, but nothing. Nothing happens. I can't even imagine one specific conscious experience I've never had before. But we know that, for example, pigeons have 4 color receptors to our 3. So pigeons probably are living in a richer color world than we are. And we can't even imagine one specific color that those pigeons might be enjoying. And so I'm saying that the conscious agents aren't in space and time. Space and time are just certain conscious experiences that we have. And we just, our imagination gets trapped inside them. But I'm saying, expand your imagination. You recognize that you can't even imagine concretely one specific color. Now try to understand that there are entire new sensory systems that beyond taste, smell, touch, hearing, and so forth, there are countless other new, literally kinds of sensory systems, kinds of conscious experiences that we've never had, that other conscious agents have. So this is where conscious agents are living. They're exploring Gödel's candy store. There's an infinite variety of kinds of conscious experience out there. We're just stuck in one, you know, there's a few chocolates that we've got, and we've assumed that that's the whole thing. I'm saying, no, there's, if we're in anything, we're in Gödel's candy store. So that I guess if I were to answer your question, where are we? We're in Gödel's candy store, this infinite variety of different possibilities of conscious experience. One kind of conscious experience variety is of a space and time, and you know, that's three-dimensional, and of objects in space and time. That's just one chocolate and an infinite shelf. And we've assumed that that one chocolate was the whole thing. And it's but it is possible for us. I mean, I think if you look back, most people would have thought, how in the world could we imagine that the Earth isn't the center of the universe? That seems just fine. Just look, it's not moving. The Earth is still. The Sun, Moon, and stars are going around us. It's hard. It was so hard for us to imagine this. We disbelieved it so much that we literally burned people at the stake and tortured them, you know, five centuries ago or roughly. Because when they said that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, we tortured them. That's how strongly we were stuck on our perceptions. But we got over it. And we now recognize that it's in some sense just obvious that that was a mistake on our part. And now I'm saying the next mistake to recognize is space-time and microphysical particles in objects like the Sun and the Moon and neurons. We've assumed that neurons exist, that space exists when it's not perceived, and it's a final reality. That's just a rookie mistake. We have to let go of that. It's just one little candy in Gödel's infinite candy store. And so consciousness is, if it's anywhere, it's exploring this infinite candy store, and that's what it's up to. So we're not stuck in one of the candies, namely space-time. We're playing with that candy. We're outside of it.
Well, then we're never going to do anything but make mistakes, according to you. We will never do anything but make mistakes.
Well, if we persist in assuming that the way we see reality now is the truth, then we will always be mistaken. If we let go and say, our forms of our perception are just our forms of our perception, and there's an infinite variety of other forms of perception that are just as equally valid as the ones that we're having now, then according to this, in this framework, that would be a true statement. We would actually be having a genuine insight. Now, of course, what it does also entail is, in some sense, extreme humility is appropriate. The range of experiences that we have and that we can have, or that we could even concretely imagine, is trivial compared to the range of experiences that are out there. And so there's a deep humility that's sort of, you know, engendered by this. It recognizes we're looking at one candy in an infinite candy store. We made a mistake of thinking the candy was the final reality. That's physicalism. It's the mistake of taking our little set of conscious experiences, our little framework, and assuming it's the final reality. So we let go of that. But as soon as we let go of that, now it's humbling. We can never, right now, at least, we don't have the technology. Maybe we'll get some technology. That would be interesting. That would allow us to directly experience new forms of sensory modalities. That would be tremendous. It's quite possible as we develop the mathematics of conscious agents and their projection into our space-time interface and understand that we might get new technologies that allow us to literally upgrade to new kinds of conscious experiences. That's certainly possible. I do think this, if this framework is correct, if it's on the right track at least, the technologies that are going to open up to us are going to make all of our current technologies seem like nothing, right? Science, as brilliant as it has been, heretofore, science has only been the study of our headset. We're just now, in the last few years, with the work that like Nimar Khani-Hamed and others are doing in physics and so forth, we're just for the first time starting to use the tools of science to try to peek outside of our headset, outside of space and time. There's an infinite variety of things to explore. So all science has done so far is looked at one headset, one little candy in Gödel's infinite candy store. We're now realizing, geez, there's a whole candy store out there. Well, I think the tools of science are up to the task. And that's the interesting thing, where we can't concretely go with our imaginations. I can't concretely even imagine a specific new color experience. Nevertheless, I can, as a scientist, model the kinds of color experiences that perhaps a pigeon has with four dimensions of color, you know, color experiences instead of our three. They have four cone systems to our three cone systems for color. So I can go there with mathematics. Einstein couldn't concretely imagine a four-dimensional space-time, but he needed to go to a 4D space-time to write down his theory of general relativity. So the mathematics allowed Einstein, it took him 7 years or so to do it, but that's Einstein. So, you know, this isn't easy work. If it takes an Einstein 7 years to do it, well, the rest of us mortals, it's going to be hard work. But we do have this wonderful gift. The gift of mathematics does seem to allow us to go conceptually where we can't go perceptually. We can conceptually explore a four-dimensional structure or a 100-dimensional structure or spaces that have no structure and so forth. Maybe they only have a topology or an order or some group structure, but they might not have, some kind of notion, the very notion of dimension might not be applicable to them. We can go there. So we can explore with mathematics. And in this particular case, our exploration outside of space-time, once we understand the realm of conscious agents, how it projects into space-time, the technologies that will open up are like this. Imagine someone who is a wizard at, say, Grand Theft Auto. We're all impressed. This guy can do all these tricks that we didn't think were even imaginable. And so we're just all in awe about this wizard who's playing Grand Theft Auto. But now imagine someone who's a software programmer who actually knows the computer hardware and the software behind the game. Well, that guy, even if he's not very good at driving cars, he can empty the tank of the wizard. He can give the wizard's car a flat tire. He can alter the very space-time geometry in which the game is being played.
That's
in other
God.
Words,
that is God.
That seems to the person in the game, it seems like God. And I think that once we have this theory, if conscious agent theory is correct, the next step we're supposed to take. Once we have that and we have its mapping onto our space-time headset, we will be able to play with the headset. We will be able to play with the very parameters of space and time themselves. And that's going to be profound. Right now, of all the galaxies that we can see, only 3% could we ever reach traveling as fast as we possibly could within space-time, approaching the speed of light. 97% of the galaxies that are visible to us right now, we can never visit. In principle, we can never visit traveling through space-time. But what if we don't have to travel through space-time? What if we can step outside the headset and realize, oh, well, no, there's this other set of tools that we have. I can change the parameters of space-time. All sorts of new technologies are going to open up. So it's going to be incredibly powerful. But we have to let go of space-time and physicalism and microphysical particles and neurons and brains as fundamental. That's what we have to let go of before we can move to this new, more sophisticated realm of both scientific theory and technological application.
If this is either a metaphor or an analogy, which is the only way we have been proceeding thus far in this hour and 18 minutes and 26 seconds, here's the way I've always looked at it. There's this infinite dark blue ocean. We swim through it underwater. We swim through it. Then we pop up and we look around for a microsecond, a millisecond. We look around. My idea of what we're supposed to do when we pop up is to gain as much information as we possibly can in that infinitesimal moment. Then we go back down, we swim forever. That's it. And what I'm understanding now is my ocean is outside of space and time. Because right. I pop up, I gain it. I mean, to me, being as good, if you will, a person as you can be, is to use that space-time to gain as much information as you possibly can with the best of intentions and hard work and inspiration. And then what does it mean? I have no idea. That's my understanding of what this is.
Right. Well, I think that that's quite compatible with what I'm saying. I might put a slightly different, gloss on it. I might say that it's about exploration and curiosity and enjoying the process of, the kid in the candy store kind of feeling. Like if you're a kid in the candy store, how does that feel? It's just like, oh, wow, look at that one. Oh, let me taste that one. Oh, wow. And you just find that there's endless things to explore, and there's sort of a joy and a curiosity and an excitement and so forth. And that seems to me, it's an idea about what this might be all about, and what's a healthy attitude in this is one of just endless exploration. So, what we call an ant, well, that's our best interface understanding of some other set of conscious agents that are doing their own kind of exploration. Who knows what they're experiencing, what they're feeling? We assume it's very small compared to ours. We assume that the what we call an ant has a much more limited range of conscious experiences, a much more dull life than ours. But that may just be an artifact of our headset giving us very little insight. I mean, our headset gives us little insight.
We assume that rocks have no consciousness. I mean,
well, and that's an important point for me to make. Strictly speaking, no human body is conscious, no animal body is conscious, and no rock is conscious in the framework that I'm talking about, right? Every one of these things is just an icon in my space-time interface. So strictly speaking, when I look at you, the body that I see is not conscious. When I look at a rock, the rock that I see is not conscious. But I know that when I look at what I call you and I see a body, your consciousness is not the body I see, but the body that I see is a portal in my interface to your consciousness. It allows me to be influenced by your consciousness, and it allows your consciousness to influence me, and I get some understanding of your consciousness. So strictly speaking, human bodies aren't conscious, animal bodies aren't conscious, no physical object is conscious, and so also a rock isn't conscious. But in the case of a human body, the unconscious symbol that I've got is giving me insight into a consciousness outside of space and time that I'm interacting with. In the case of a rock, that symbol is giving me very limited information about consciousnesses that I'm interacting with. So I'm definitely not saying that a rock is conscious or made up of consciousnesses. But again, I'm not saying that the human body is conscious or made up of consciousnesses. Anything inside space and time is, strictly speaking, not conscious. It's just a symbol.
It's so funny because you're a reader, I'm a reader. And so, like, when you say that, I'm thinking, wow, that's like magical realism. That's like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That's like 100 years of solitude, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And I just also realize when you keep talking about this candy store, which you seem to love, and I just realize I'm sitting in my – right now I'm sitting alone because of what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And social distancing. I'm alone in my relatively large independent bookstore, and I'm looking at my books. Wow. So essentially, I'm in Gödel's candy store.
Yes.
I have the minds of all of these people here. They're here, outside of space-time. And when a 12-year-old boy comes in, even though he has Amazon recommendations, he walks up my book ladders, my library ladders, which is something I've always wanted to have, which is what you're saying about what I should also gain when I pop up from my ocean. I should also gain this enjoyment. And so when I climb up my library ladder, or the little boy does, not only does he see the book he wants, he sees the book on either side. Yes. And one of those books might be the book that changes his life. And you're right. When he reads the book, as my children do, thankfully, when you read the book and you're reading the book the way you read a book when you have to read it, and you take it to the restaurant and your parents are upset, but you're reading at the table and you can't stop, you are outside space and time.
Yes, that's right. You're on your own wonderful world of exploration. And so we need to free our minds, to free our imaginations. This is just one piece of candy. We're enjoying it, but there's an infinite variety of other candies to explore. And it is that's what it's about. It's about exploration. And one thing that comes up in this often is, well, what about death then? What is death in this framework? And again, I think the virtual reality metaphor is very, very helpful. Suppose you go with a bunch of friends to a virtual reality arcade, and you play, say, virtual volleyball at a beach. And so you put on your headset and bodysuit, and so do your friends, and you're all immersed in, you know, sand and net and palm trees, and you see the volleyball, and you start playing. And you have a good time, and then one of your friends says, yeah, I'm thirsty. I need a drink. I'll be back in a minute. And, you know, he takes off his headset and bodysuit, and his avatar collapses motionless on the sand. Well, in that virtual reality, he's effectively dead. He's unplugged from that virtual reality. But he's not dead. He just unplugged from that VR. And that's what this theory of conscious agents and this theory of space-time entail. Space-time isn't the final reality, and, you know, avatars in space-time that are motionless doesn't entail that the consciousness itself is gone. Whereas if you take space-time to be fundamental, if you're a physicalist, of course, if consciousness is created by brain activity, then yes, when the brain is dead, then the consciousness must cease to exist. But this other framework in which no, space-time is not fundamental. We're not little bit players in space-time. We create space-time. It's just our data structure. It's not something that we're in. It's something we create. So in that framework, then stepping out of space-time isn't the death of consciousness. It's perhaps just moving to another candy in Girdle's candy store.
Well, that's good. That's very good. I have a friend who died just before Christmas. And there's four reasons why I miss him. One, I miss him, and I think about him every day. Two, he was a survivalist, so he had, for good or for bad, he had 50,000 rounds of ammunition, he had Claymore mines, he had a bazooka, he had a submachine gun, and whoa, he had 20,000 MREs.
Wow.
And his next reason is he wanted to protect me and my family. And he would have, if worse comes to worse in this pre-apocalyptic, if it is, situation, mm-hmm, then he would be there and allow us to survive longer. And he even had liquid morphine and rib spreaders.
wow.
And lastly, he was awaiting with enthusiasm the apocalypse so he could implement all of this. Sounds like he might not have been a great person, but he was an incredibly great person. And so he's not here, but I'm talking about him. I'm remembering him. And once again, tipping close to solipsism and talk as you were talking about death, this existence that he had remains for me. I'm angry at him for dying. Hmm. And I wake up and I think about him every day. Or, okay, enough of that. Let me switch to this. What about dreams?
Right. So dreams actually are there's lots of things, of course, to say about dreams. But one thing in connection of our current conversation is that dreams once again show the power we have to create virtual worlds, right? When you're dreaming, yeah, you are you know, sometimes I fly in my dreams, right? I can't fly in everyday life, but in my dreams, I can see trees, I can fly above them, and I can fly over stairs. I don't have to walk down the stairs and so forth. So you're able to make all this stuff up. So I think one of the many takeaways from dreams is to just see, yes, we have this creative ability to create virtual worlds. And in fact, you know, some very famous philosophers have asked whether everyday life is just a dream. Descartes asked that kind of question. I mean, I wake up from my dream, but how do I know that I really have wakened? I'm awake. Maybe this, what I call everyday life, is also a dream. And you know, I'm not saying that this is merely a dream, but I'm saying that dreams have this the same kind of creative power that I'm claiming everyday life is. Everyday life is a headset, a virtual reality headset that we're creating. So dreams really, again, show that if I, for example, said we're creating all this, but we couldn't dream, that would be a problem. So dreams show that we do have that kind of creative power.
And also it does show that, because when we dream, we are indeed outside of space-time. Right. We are not in the space-time continuum.
That's right. The space-time of our dream is not something we're stuck in. It's something we make up. And that's what I'm saying is true of what we call the normal space-time. It's something we're making up. It's not something we're stuck in.
Well, we should end this now because this is as close to understanding you as I'm ever going to get. And I don't want to mess it up. So let me hold on to it. I'm here at the bookstore. I can find a book that continues this thought process for me. But I want to thank you so much for being here and for going through this. I'm sorry if anything I did was tedious, but it's important to me. And these three books, and yours especially, have given me, especially at the conclusion of this talk, a lot more insight into things that I've thought about all my life. So thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much, Sam. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you. And also best wishes in this very difficult time for all of us with this virus.
Thank you. You too. So we were talking with Donald Hoffman. His new book is The Case Against Reality, Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes. This is the third time I've been talking to people who've been writing about consciousness and reality, and they all have these books that have these incredibly long titles and subtitles with colons in them. You could talk about the titles for the entire hour. Anyway, he was fascinating. We talked for hour and a half. Anyway, so that's the third one. And if you go to our menu and our list of what we got going on, you can see the other two. And in addition to that, during these trying times, I think it's fun to join us, take your mind off of things. The guy Philip Goff, he wrote Galileo's Error, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness. So that's the other one. And then it's good because Rebecca's gotten me all these science books. The other guy we'll be talking to is Robert Sawyer, who's going to talk about his new book, The Oppenheimer Alternative. He's one of the few guys that has won both the Hugo and the Nebula Award, which are the best awards you can give to science fiction authors. So I'm really excited about all three of these, four of them. So keep safe, enjoy yourself, read, which is what you can do right now, and join us next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.